Welcome, boys and girls. This is Henrik. You're listening to Red Eyes Radio. Our guest today is Frank Raymond. He's been with us two times before on the show, talking about an outsider's insight into the white mind and the aspects of Caucasian culture that transcends biological needs. We're going to continue our discussion today to talk about the many ways that Western culture and attitudes differ from the incoming one, the clash that is now occurring when an unrelenting stream of migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, and economic migrants pour into the West. Frank was born in the Indian subcontinent and spent his early life in Calcutta, Darjeeling, and Dhaka in Bangladesh. He went to college and university in England and later returned to Bangladesh, where he spent many years running an industrial business and immersing himself in the mind and culture of the people of India. For the past 20-plus years, Raymond has resided in Vancouver, British Columbia, in Canada. And due to witnessing the slow destruction of the once proud Canada, he was inspired to write his first book, Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells. Stay tuned for more. Frank, welcome back. Thank you so much for coming on the show again. It's always a delight to have you here. Thank you for returning to us.
Henrik, I'm returning partly because, mainly for one reason, that you are one of the few alternative channels that have actually expanded your reach. You've got TV going, you've got regular daily commentary and talks and discussions. From being simply a radio podcasting channel, you've certainly expanded impressively.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we have big plans of what to do, and a lot of things are possible now these days with the technology and stuff like that. There's no reason why we can't, you know, expand and do more. So one day, hopefully, we'll be a daily channel with running commentary about the events of the world. We certainly need it.
I think it's inevitable.
Exactly. No, it is. We have to have our own media. We have to start picking these things apart. Otherwise, what are we going to do, right?
The resistance is getting stronger, so the resistance media will get stronger. We are on the winning side now.
Absolutely. A lot of people talking about the kind of topics that we bring to the table. We have presidential candidates mentioning us. We have media, you know, being freaked out about the rise of all of this. I'm encouraged, after all. We're on the right path, it feels like. But Frank, it's always a pleasure to speak with you and hear your stories. And you have an idea where to go today. You expressed a desire to come back on the show, and you have an outline. So why don't you introduce where you'd like to begin today?
Okay. So I wanted to start off by a very brief brief amplification of some past issues we talked about. And then I'll go into the topic I had in mind for today. So suppose I surprise you we talked in the past about the fact that white people physically had more diversity among themselves than the rest of the world put together. You know, that the rest of the world all has black hair and dark brown eyes, or dull brown eyes, all of them. Whereas among whites there are so many hair colors and so many eye colors. So when we talk about diversity, you lose it if you, when whites are gone, or you have more diversity than can possibly be imagined. Remember we talked about that?
Oh yeah, of course, absolutely.
Now, people don't realize it, but there are other things that distinguish whites. I'll just mention one. I was talking to some Asian people the other day. And when they go to a beach, they really like going to beaches to watch all the white women. And you wondered why. Of course, there are obvious reasons. White women have the more attractive pale skin, and pale faces, which show the expression and the openness and so much better than a dark face. The dark is the absence of color. But one of the reasons that they like looking at these white bodies, you never suspected that the white body has many skin tones, many colors. You see a white person on the beach, and you have to see it for yourself, not through pictures or a video. If you're there, you'll find that they have quite a few colors on a single body. A white person will have the ivory color of the skin, and then the reddish near the cheeks, and reddish in places, and there'll be a kind of vermilion brownish red. So it's a kind of a symphony in colors quite often. Not every time, but quite often a white body will have a symphony in colors, and you see that particularly on a beach. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I haven't actually thought about that before.
Yeah, so you have some ivory white, and then you have some pink. and you have a brownish pink as well. And that makes it more attractive than a monotone colored body.
Interesting.
If you put a black woman on the beach, it's all one color.
Right.
Right? Less interesting. Not a symphony of colors. And that's why your Swedish Nordic women are so attractive. There's a lot of colors there in their face. Just look at the face of a Nordic woman. You'll see the brown or blonde hair or maybe red hair, the whitish skin, and the very different color of the eyes. The blue or the green is very different, and the lips are red. Quite a few colors there.
Yeah, true.
Makes it more interesting, whereas on the opposite end of the scale, you'll see a African Negro face, and it's all one color. The hair is black, the skin is black, the eyes are dark, and the lips are black. Much less interesting, isn't it?
It's funny because we hear all the time, not even only in Sweden, but that we're dull and plain and boring. We have prime ministers talking about how we all look the same in Sweden. That's true.
Well, I urge people to just look at two images, one of a Scandinavian woman, the face, that is, and one of an African woman. And guess what? You'll find the Scandinavian one is so much more vivid and striking and startling and looks at you, seems to jump out at you, that image. And the black one is rather boring, and you can't quite see all the features because it is black. It doesn't show, display the features very well, that black color. It absorbs light, you see. And you'll see the difference in the coloration. So many colors for the Scandinavian and only one color for the African. That's why all over the world, people value the Caucasian women. Well, that's one of the that's one of the reasons. With the multiplicity of colors is something a European might take for granted, but we don't. You know.
Right.
Yeah, so I can assure you that colored women would kill to have that striking this palette of colors on their face. They'd kill for it.
Well, you know,
you don't know.
So sometimes I feel it's a kind of, if I can't have it, no one will, right? It's kind of a, instead of settling with this idea that it's like, yeah, diversity comes with all the differences we have and kind of accepting that, there seems to be a level of jealousy there, specifically when it's concerning the women anyway. I've noticed that.
Well, it certainly is there. Envy is omnipresent, racial envy, and that, of course, leads to racial hatred. And that is that's something I'll come to in a little bit. I'll give you a specific example of that.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely envy. Envy leads to hatred. And you have to keep, you know, people have to be conscious that when they're weaker, when they can't defend themselves, when they're a minority, that will be a very big problem. You will not be able to protect your own people, protect your own daughters when the time comes.
Very worrying, extremely worrying.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have talked in the past about the energy conservation constraint, right?
Yes.
What I mentioned was that, well, very briefly, colored people are very strongly imbued with a energy conservation constraint, which constrains them to look out for, number one, to look out for material things, for food, for experienced biological needs such as sex and love, but not go beyond into something like abstract mathematics or philosophy so much, not go beyond into, say, rock climbing. Rock climbing doesn't put bacon on the table. We talked about that, and I said that's what makes a white society so much more vibrant, with people going parasailing and parachuting and, you know, hiking in large numbers. Remember?
Absolutely, yeah. And I want to say as well, by the way, that folks go back in the archives and listen to the two shows that we've done with Frank already. Some great stuff in there, some very interesting analysis, you know, some of the problems that we discuss on the show, and Frank has a kind of a unique position to discuss them, as he's been, you know, basically seen many different cultures and people, lived in different parts of the world, and therefore I think is uniquely equipped to kind of discuss these maybe more pertinent than other people. So definitely check those two shows out, folks.
And of course, all that is, a lot of that is covered in my book. Those who read it come back to me saying, oh, we never suspected all these differences, never suspected they had these unique qualities. The book was Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells, and I'll just mention very briefly, it's available on Amazon.com and all the Amazon outlets, and right now, it is now available on paperback as well as ebook.
Great. You said it converted a couple of liberals, too. Tell us about that briefly, if you can.
Oh, yes. I have checked out more than a dozen liberals that have got them to read the book, and they were liberals, very fanatically liberal. But after they read the whole book, they're different. They've changed their minds.
Excellent.
They have come around to becoming patriots all of a sudden.
Nice. Well done.
Now, what they told me was that the things that I mentioned in the book about the way of life they would lose, or the soul of Caucasian man and woman, of the unique qualities of whites, no one ever mentioned it to them. They said, no one ever talks about it. You know, this was all new to them. When I mentioned in the book that they go have fancy dress parties and will dress up for a fancy dress party and not be ashamed to walk down the street, catch a bus or a train to go to a fancy dress party, well, they're not ashamed to dress up as Poison Ivy or Batman, but no colored person would be seen dead doing that. And they don't have such a thing as a fancy dress party in the whole colored world. Never has been. Now, they were surprised. They said, we didn't know that. But after reading the book and reading a lot of little details like that, details such as, there's no such thing as a dog show in the colored world. They said, we never suspected that there's no such thing. So it does. If you have friends who are like relations, brothers, sisters, cousins, friends whom you want to enlighten or to come around to the nationalist point of view, persuade them to read that book. Buy them a copy.
And then tell them Frank is of Indian descent as well, and then they'll maybe be more inclined to listen. A lot of liberals are like that, right? So
I hope so. One hopes.
Yeah.
But talking about the different activities that the white does that goes beyond the material, beyond the earthbound, beyond what puts meat on the table, I'll just say that a lot of people have been emailing me and mentioning things, and I can't mention everything in one talk, but have you heard of geocaching?
Yes, I actually have several. When I've gone out to, you know, some of these old burial sites of these mounds and tumulus, Kurgan hill mounds, which is basically, you know, the ancient way of the pre-Christian way of burying people. When I go out to some of these, I usually and search for either the GPS location where I'm at or whatever. I usually get a lot of hits for geocaching sites where people go out and hide stuff in the vicinity of these places, you know?
Yes, it's very big in Canada. People put some stuff, not expensive stuff, just interesting stuff, in a little plastic container that's fairly well sealed. They hide it somewhere, and they even put a logbook into it. You write into the logbook your name and when you found this cache. And they hide it somewhere in a hollow tree or under a log or under rocks, and you give people put it on a website with the GPS coordinates, and people go out there, and if they find it, they put their name in the log, and they might add a few things. They might take something and exchange something, or they might add a few objects, and it's a bit of fun. And, you know, above all, it gets people out. It gets them walking. It gets them out into nature. It gets them some exercise to go out in the countryside and look for stuff. And it's fun. But you know something? It is a purely white activity. All the people into geocaching are whites. Now they say there's no difference between races, and as soon as Chinese and Indonesian people come to Canada or America, they'll become as American as you and, you know, as you.
Right.
But they don't go geocaching, do they?
Good point.
Geocaching has something interesting called the travel bug. You can put a travel bug into your little box, and the idea is if someone finds that travel bug, they will then put it in a box somewhere else, and it'll be recorded as this little bug moves from one place to another. You can track it on the computer on the website, and some of these travel bugs go across the country and into Europe. A guy might find a travel bug in a geocache somewhere and take it to Europe, and then he'll say, okay, now it's this travel bug number so-and-so has now traveled to Germany. That can be quite interesting.
Yeah,
it's a bit of fun.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, a bit of fun. That's the kind of fun thing that is not material, not an experienced biological need that only whites do, because they'll do things that are not strictly material. For example, rock sculptures. I go hiking a lot, and I see by the trail sometimes people make little rock sculptures, you know, a flat rock and then another one on top of it, another one balanced on top. They make a kind of something a little interesting with these rocks. And sometimes they make a cairn, a pile of stones, and sometimes a stone is somewhat cylindrical in shape and it can look like a pillar. And they make a little shape with rocks. I've never seen a non-white do that. That's kind of strange, but no one seems to take out the time to do these things out of interest, to make a little rock sculpture just for the hell of it. And they make the trail more interesting to walk by. Yeah? Now, whenever I say one of these things, there's some little pest or persnickety type who'll say, no, no, you're wrong. There is this exception or that. And somebody will turn up right now and say, what about the Inukchuks? Now, for those who don't know, Native Indians at one time made a rock sculpture that looked like a human being. You know, looked a little bit like a man out of rocks. And they called it an Inukchuk. But the Inukchuk is not a fun thing. It's a very functional thing. It points the way. It points the way towards a destination or towards a pool of water so that the person can get water to drink and not die out.
So it's a road sign, basically.
It's like a road sign. Exactly. You're right. It's like a road sign. An Inukchuk is not a fun thing. It's not a hobby. It's not a recreation. It's a very functional thing. So when I say rock sculpture, I mean just that, sculpture for art.
For the heck of it.
Yeah, for the heck of it.
Yeah.
There's something else white people started up and still do. It's called the time capsule. You know what that is, right?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, we had one that was found just recently, apparently, by Mussolini under the obelisk that he built in Rome in the 30s. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
The fascist message to the future. Anyway, go on.
Oh, yeah. You're absolutely right. I heard about that. You're absolutely right. There was a time capsule. People have been doing this out of a sense of connection to future generations and to the future. Something from the past to the present, something from the present to the future. And right here in Vancouver, a time capsule from 1936 was dug up by the Vancouver Historical Society back in 2006. And they found it fascinating to see how life had changed and how people lived back then. All those photographs, all those letters of ordinary people, all the objects they used, the kind of stoves they used it back in those days. Now, that's not something you'll find in any non-white society. In the one time it was done in India, it was done for a vain purpose. India had this rather dictatorial leader named Indira Gandhi. She just wasn't going to give up power easily. But she buried a time capsule to glorify herself, to represent herself as a kind of semi-goddess, as an eternal leader, as the one person who led India in the post-imperial times. And guess what? There was a kerfuffle over it. There was a fight. There were a lot of protests about this time capsule, and they had it dug up and the contents destroyed.
Really?
Yeah. Political opponents actually had it destroyed.
Nice.
Instead of doing it just as something, as an expression to future generations, as something of historical interest or value, they actually turned it into a political game. Unfortunate. But I did mention to you, but you should note that the time capsule goes back to something we talked about before, that Caucasians have a unique connection with the time stream, something of the past, something of the future, you know, futuristic stuff.
Right.
The time, the book, novel, The Time Machine by
H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells. The idea of time travel, of compression of time. This time capsule idea is part of that white comfort with the idea of the continuum of time. Not just living in the present, but thinking of time as a continuum. That's a very Caucasian, or very strongly Caucasian kind of thing. But I really wanted to talk about the fact that there is a Vancouver Historical Society, and there is a Burnaby Historical Society. I live in a sub-city of Vancouver called Burnaby. We have a historical society here, and they look at this city that was only about 150 years old, and yet they want to trace how it began, what the first settlements were, where was there the first farm in this very busy place called Granville Street, very busy, very built up, very urban. But at one time, there was only one farm there, and then there were two, then there were three. And they want to know what happened back then, how the people lived, how it grew up. Almost throughout North America, even though some of these cities are only 150 years old, some 100 years old, there is a strong historical sense. I was in Oregon in a city called Bend some months ago.
Oh, yeah. Lana's from there, actually. Oh. I've been there many times.
That's a beautiful city, isn't
very,
it?
Very, very, yeah.
Now, by the river, I believe, there was a natural park. I saw a small concrete structure, and not small, quite big, actually. And it wasn't quite like, it was like a very large oven, I thought. Some other, and I was quite fascinated. I said, what on earth is this thing? It looks strange. It looks different. And a woman who was working there, she was working for the park, she was an employee of the parks board, told me of his history. She said that during the Depression, they tried to get people employed, and the state employed them. And they wanted them to build up things in this area, and there was no housing. So they lived in little tents, and they had this structure, both as a kind of place where they could cook, a very large oven inside it, and they could take shelter in it. And I said, well, how do you know all this? She said, I take an interest in history, in the local history, and things like this. They are part of our past. I take an interest in it. Now, there is no historical society in any city in India, in any neighborhood. What I'm trying to stress is that this is a grassroots activity. The historical societies and the interest in the history of this, of your own community and neighborhood, is a very grassroots thing. It's not of the intellectuals. It's of common people, mainly middle-class people. It's uniquely white. If you went into Africa or Indonesia or Thailand, you wouldn't find people taking an interest in the history of their community, of their locality. There's no such thing there. You know?
Interesting. Yeah. It's partly because of necessity, as you mentioned. I don't know, though. Maybe there's other reasons for it as well. It's interesting. But one of the things people should know if they're in Canada, by the way, that I want to recommend about this, is there's a series that ran, I think it was on PBS, but it was in Canada. It was about the different settlements of Canada. One really good one was called Quest for the Bay, where actually eight of these people, actually they rebuilt a York boat, a wooden boat, and actually trekked the same way that people who fur traders did for the Hudson Bay Company in like the 1840s. And they retraced their path and stuff like that, and they made it into a television series. Really good stuff, and it was like very interesting. I bet you really unique as well in the context of things here.
Yeah, I think that would be a wonderful thing to watch. It was a heroic time. It wasn't easy for those people.
No,
to,
God, it was
to search the bay.
It's amazing to see how these people today was basically they were more or less unable to perform some of the things that they did, you know, in the 1840s.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Yeah, so whites have a glorious history and of carving a civilization out of the wilderness, acts of heroism, and yet in schools they're taught that they have a bad history. And sometimes they're taught they have no history. In fact, the common white person in Canada thinks we have no history, and what's more, we have no culture. They actually say that to me.
Yeah, amazing.
Amazing. But you have something else here called the Heritage Home. Many a time they will keep a house as a heritage home, and that's very common in England, and they won't let you change it. Certainly they won't let you destroy it, because it is a heritage home. It's part of your heritage. This is how houses looked 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago. To preserve something of your past, to know what it was like, to have a connection with the past. I don't believe there's a single heritage home in the whole of India. And I doubt if there's one in the whole of South America or Africa. They just say, oh, well, destroy that home. We need this now for a new three-story building.
Right.
What I'm trying to say is that whites have a uniquely strong, I'm not saying it's unique, but uniquely strong historical sense. And that is at the grassroots level. As soon as a person has a bit of comfort and doesn't have to be struggling to pay the rent and to, you know, get by for the month, he takes an interest in other things. And one of these things is a sense of history. I don't find that in any other society. I don't find that in any other race, rather, so strongly. It is there, certainly is there, but say the Chinese, they preserve the massive monuments, the really historical ones, the Gate of Heavenly Peace, the Palace of the Ming Emperor, but not the things of the common man.
You know, right, like, yeah, interesting.
Here in the Fraser Valley, which is not far off, I was going by this neighborhood and they said there's a museum here. Well, the museum was a very small museum. It was like two rooms. But, so it's a very grassroots, common people's museum. And what they had was the sewing machines and that were used 150 years ago by the first settlers, the kind of rocking chairs they had. What did an oven look like in a common home, in a common kitchen, an oven of 100 years ago? I was rather surprised. You don't find that in other races and societies. So, at the end of it, the whites do have a uniquely strong historical sense at the grassroots level, and they have a great attachment to the past of their folk, to their progress through time as a folk. Now, you wouldn't believe that to see some of the whites of today who wear a baseball cap backwards, who cannot read a block of text, who are always playing with their video games and cell phones. You wouldn't believe that, would you?
Right.
The New World Order is trying to destroy that quintessentially white nature. It wants to turn these whites into proles, into MTV watching, hip-hop rapping, Hollywood watching idiots.
That's right.
But when you take away all that, if whites had a society of their own, if they could have a society of their own, it would breed a people with a historical sense, with a sense of great many hobbies. It would take out the true nature of their people. Just as today the Japanese have a country of their own, a media of their own, it brings out the true nature of the Japanese. You too could have that. It is being destroyed. They are vulgarizing your people, but it's there. Inside them it's there. It'll only come out when you get your freedom and attain a homeland of your own. And it would be a wonderful homeland. It would have a lot of wonderful things: geocaching, rock sculptures, historical societies, heritage homes. It would be a great homeland. Well, when I talked about all these things, someone made a comment in the past two shows we did. Someone made a comment about this fact that whites had all these hobbies and all these things like bird watching and so forth that are more than material. And they said, well, I suppose Frank is right. At the end of the day, I suppose I always knew that the colored people I work with are okay, but they're boring.
Right.
They're okay, but they're boring. They don't have other interests. Don't particularly like reading, say, science fiction. Oh, well, I won't comment on that. I certainly had a chuckle when I read that.
Right.
Okay. So that was dealing with amplifying on some of the stuff we talked about in the past. Now today I wanted to talk about something called the self versus the universal outlook. And you'll notice it is related to the energy conservation constraint. Freedom from the energy conservation constraint, freedom from the strictly material, the freedom to want to go bird watching or geocaching, it derives from something bigger. A person who does this has a outward-looking, universe-oriented outlook as opposed to the selfish, self-oriented, self-serving outlook. So the bigger picture in this is the universe-oriented outlook as opposed to the self-oriented outlook. A self-centered person, bent on serving himself, will necessarily not have a universe-oriented outlook. He will not expend time on things out there in the universe, like saving habitats for whales. He will prefer to save himself and concentrate on his material needs. So the self versus universe model envisages a vast universe, a forest, the ocean, the planet, and the human collectives on the planet. It's a very big issue. The universe, the universal outlook looks at all those things. It even looks into outer space. But today's talk, or this talk, will be more limited. I'll be talking about the human collectives only. How a person, the behavior of a person, of one part of the universe, only his fellow beings. Today I'll talk about how a person relates to his fellow beings, which means his neighbors, his business connections, his neighborhood, his society as a whole. I suppose you could call that social behavior. And I'll speak of the social behavior of different races. And this is such a vast subject that I doubt we'll get very far in one interview. But if people find it interesting, we can have another interview to continue with it.
Sure.
Yeah? So, first of all, I will say you will need an outsider viewpoint to know about yourself and about what distinguishes you from non-whites. The outsider, you know, people will agree with that, that often an outsider can tell you more about yourself. But you also need the outsider viewpoint from something else. You need it to know what the out-group is like. What are Africans like? What are mestizos in Brazil like? And you know why you need an outsider to tell you? Because the media lies to you about
that. That's right.
That's why.
Yeah, that's right.
The media lies to you, so you do need an outsider sometimes to tell you the lowdown, the real facts. You know, you have heard the expression they used in, especially on black Americans, give me the lowdown, man.
Right.
Now, the liberal lemming, the liberal lemming or the muggle, you know what a muggle is?
Yeah, I think we talked about that last time. Didn't you mention it last time?
Yeah.
Muggle?
The muggle. Yeah, it's from Harry Potter books.
That's right.
Muggles
yeah.
are ordinary people, normal people, normies, non-magical people.
The plebes, right? That's another offensive
yeah.
term for it, yeah.
Whereas Harry Potter and his group, they have magical powers. They're not muggles. The average muggle, and certainly the liberal lemming, has this idea from the media and from the regime that the colored peoples are better, nicer. Not just the same, but better, nicer, kinder. Only they're handicapped by poverty. That's the only difference. If they had prosperity, they'd be the same as whites. And sometimes I've heard the mainstream person says, you know, I'm sick of Western culture. It's so destructive, so disrespectful of nature, so disrespectful of other people. They're sick of Western culture. They want non-Western culture. And so they believe and they imply that the non-white cultures are superior. So given the level of misinformation, you really do need a third person from the third world to tell you what third world people are like. Now, I'll kind of give you a nice little real-life story that will illustrate the depth of the ignorance, okay? So one day, I was on a dating site, which is a very popular one called Plenty of Fish, so I got to meet a lot of women through it, for coffee dates. And one day I met this woman who said, meet me at Granville Island, which is a charming little island, but very urban, but full of interesting little shops and artists and glass blowers and the like, you know. People who do all kinds of jewelry making. And in the course of the conversation, I mentioned to her that, you know what, one of the reasons that white people have more successful societies and people want to come to white societies is that they're less corrupt. All the other races, they're very corrupt. And she jumped at me. She said, that's the most racist, ridiculous thing. It's not just racist, it's false.
Right.
What about all our politicians, all our bankers? Look at at that time there had been a banker's bailout. There was the massive bailout of Wall Street firms and banks. And so there had been a scandal. All the banks had gone broke and bankrupt. They'd made bad investments or badly managed, or they'd been stealing too much money, I suppose. And there was a massive bailout, and of course corrupt politicians for their corruption, for their campaign contributions or whatever other promises, they got the taxpayer to bail out the bankers. And she was talking about that, and she said, you know, what about all the corruption in our countries? Well, how ridiculous. I thought to myself, I looked at her, and I said, so what's the end of the story that in India and Thailand and Indonesia and Malaya, they're not more corrupt? So absolutely not. They're just the same as us. Now, I had to stare at her, and I said, well, you know, she doesn't know about an American businessman who went to Thailand to do some business. And he heard that you have to pay a bribe to every official. And this particular official wants a bribe of 50,000 baht. Baht is their currency. And the way that you apparently do give a bribe in Thailand is, as you sit talking to the official, you suddenly drop your wallet to the floor and you say, oh, you, he's talking to the official, you've just dropped your wallet containing 50,000 baht. That's the way they bribe people in Thailand. I tell the official that, sir, you've just dropped your wallet containing 50,000 baht. And the guy says, oh, so I have. Oh, dear, so I have. And he picks it up and he puts it in his pocket. Now, an American businessman had heard that and said, you know, he'd heard that this particular official took 50,000. And he played the game. He dropped a wallet to the floor and said, oh, you just dropped your wallet. Sorry, excuse me, you just dropped your wallet containing 50,000 baht. And the official looked at him blandly and unsurprised and said, no, you're wrong. I've dropped my wallet containing 200,000 baht.
You know, this is an interesting point. I hear this as well, actually, in terms of the corruption and whatever. One thing that I'm speculating a bit here because I don't know some of these countries as well as I know, you know, Scandinavian culture and European culture. But in some cases, the corruption is maybe higher level in some of the Western world because we have you have an elite that rises to the surface, but the trust generally remains very high among the regular people on the lower levels, lower tiers, if you will. However, in many other countries, it seems that corruption is kind of all across the board, right? That it's, you know, if you meet
if you meet
a government official, then you have to take care of him over here or her over there. On our level, it's usually kind of very trusting in a broader sense. But then, unfortunately, we have, of course, the bad, rotten eggs and all the scum that rises to the surface, you know, well, the top.
There, Henrik, you're absolutely on the ball. The corruption is at a very high level. There's almost none at a low level. And secondly, you are living in an occupied, alien-dominated society now, so you can't measure your society. You can't say that white characters like this. It's not a white society anymore.
Right.
The alien powers dominated. So I looked at this woman and I said, I thought it's useless telling her. But does she know what I had to go through every single day, what every single Indian, say, because I spoke about India particularly, has to go through everywhere? A normal person goes to a post office to get something that was sent to him, and he has to pay a bribe to receive his own package.
Right, exactly.
And if that package is coming from abroad, there's a bit of a customs problem, then it takes all day, and he has to bribe six people in the chain of command, all of them, to get a simple package, say contact lenses or something that they don't have there. So you order your contact lenses from abroad. Even that, he has to be harassed. Certainly at every government office, there was a man who wanted a phone line, and he couldn't get a phone number before he had to go through the whole chain of harassment and corrupt and bribing. A person needs a lot of the housing is controlled by government, so you need a housing allotment to rent a housing unit, to rent an apartment. You need a housing allotment. There's a process of oiling, flattering, and bribing. For a businessman, it's infinitely worse. When I was a businessman, I couldn't go through a day without being stopped and hounded and harassed everywhere. For example, I went to a government department to give a letter to what they call central dispatch. Your letters are given to central dispatch and you have to get a seal put on it. You have to have a receiving copy, a copy of your own, and get them to put their seal on it. Because otherwise later they'll deny having got the letter. They'll say, oh, we never got a letter, sorry. And your work is not getting through, so you've got a seal on it. So the receiving clerk, all he has to do is put a receipt seal on your copy, and you go on your way. That's all his job is to just pass it on to the right quarter. Even he asked for a bribe, just to receive a letter.
Amazing.
No.
Yeah.
It's at every level. It's not at a high level. As you said, in today's West, the corruption is at a very high level. But even the lowest class person is naturally corrupt. For example, when I was a 14-year-old boy, I was of a privileged family. We had something called a club, the recreational club with a swimming pool and tennis courts. And I'd gone swimming, and I'd left a textbook in a locker. Well, I forgot the textbook. I forgot to take it. I was in a hurry. I suppose I heard the car honking, and I rushed out. The next day when I went to get my textbook, these low-level servant or worker at the club says, yeah, we have the textbook, but it'll be a long process to get it back. I have to first get it to the X, and then X has to pass it to Y, and Y has to approve it. I said, well, I want my textbook. He said, well, it'll be a long process. It'll take a long time. It'll have to go to the chairman. It'll have to go to the secretary. But on the other hand, if you had a little consideration, if you gave me $5, it could be done fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Well, he annoyed me for 2 days in a row. I didn't get my textbook. Then I just, though I was only 14, I knew how the game was played. I went to the club secretary. When he called this man in, the man started practically shivering with fear he's going to get fired. And he said, bring that textbook now and run. So the corruption is at such a level that everyone is corrupt. And of course, when a third world person comes to the West, to the white world, he sees different standards and he gets a little surprised. I once met a Dutch boy, a young man of about 22. And I was actually going to see the tulip gardens, and I was asking the way, and this fellow was helping me out. He was an East Indian, and he had grown up in Holland. He'd been there since he was a kid. And he was inspired to go back to India, to his home country, to have a look at what the home country is like. And he was very shocked when at the airport, the customs officials at Delhi airport harassed him and annoyed him and opened every bag and kept running him around. And he realized that they want money because they're asking for it. And he said, no, I won't. I'm not going to pay you. And he flashed a little privilege and said, I'm a Dutch citizen. I'll complain to the Dutch embassy and all that. But then they said, I'll open that bag. And when he bent down to open his bag, they tore the visa page out of his passport. While he was bending down to open a bag, they tore the Indian visa out of his passport quickly. When he straightened up, they said, well, we can't let you in anyway. You don't have a visa. And he said, after that, he never went back to India.
Interesting.
No.
Yeah.
Now, it's a pity that India was actually less corrupt for a long time. For a long time, we regarded Pakistan as corrupt, Bangladesh is corrupt, Thailand is corrupt. But India was actually less corrupt for a long time.
So what happened?
Natural process, I suppose. The natural character asserted itself at some point. But now it's just as bad as anywhere else, you know.
That's a shame, yeah.
Just as bad.
It's something to do with, the creation of a commons, right? This idea of high trust society, right? These are unique traits in comparison to many other countries. And basically, what I've heard specifically about some of the more Islamic or, I guess, Arabic cultures is that they're still very much in a tribal sense. It's about the family and the extended family, and that's kind of mostly of what you try to focus on and take care of, which means that if you control any faction of civic life, you try to assert the influence that you have and kind of gain something from that yourself. And so hence you end up in this situation where you seek to take bribes to kind of use your power position, even if it's a very minor one, right? So at every little instance, you have something to combat with, you know?
Well, Henrik, you absolutely put your finger on a few points there that I'm going to come to about you. There's the tribe, the extended family, the clan, and you favor them. It is all part of this self-universal outlook. And I'm going to go right into that in a minute. You're absolutely right there. It's the taking of bribes is ignoring wider society. You're ignoring the wider universe.
Yeah.
You're preferring yourself to the wider universe. Now, this is not just government matters. An executive in a private firm will be corrupt. He'll betray his boss. Many a time I've seen... there was a man who became very rich in Bangladesh because he was importing yarn, cotton yarn, from Thailand. And he seemed to have an advantage over everyone else. So he got very rich and he bought his own cotton mill at one time. But the real story was that there was a Thai official, there was a big private firm, a private company in Thailand, very big spinning mill, cotton spinning mill. And he got in touch with one of the managers there and said, "What do you have to do, buddy? Is I'll pay for a certain quality and brand, you give me a better quality for the same money, and I'll give you a kickback." And the guy used to come once every few months to collect his kickback. And so he got a good quality yarn for a cheap price. That was a private firm, not a government firm. But corruption is there even in the private sector. So people would, of course, say it's due to poverty. It's not due to the innate nature of people. It's due to poverty. When Thailand and India become richer, they'll not be corrupt. No. That's not so. India and Thailand have got richer in the last 50 years. They have got richer.
Yeah.
They've got immensely richer. Thailand certainly has got very fairly wealthy. And you know what? The corruption has increased, not decreased.
Right.
So I looked at this white liberal woman who was telling me that, what about our politicians? What about these bankers and the bailouts? No. Those third world people are not more corrupt than we are. It was a waste of time to tell her, because she had heard all her life from the liberal media, from the education system, that those colored people are not only the same, they're better. So she has no idea. She has never had to go through a day in a city like Bombay. She's never had to face this grinding corruption, but she thinks she knows it all. And she says it with such assurance and smacks me down so confidently. These liberals, they are so stupid and so sublimely proud of their stupidity. It's just unbelievable. Well, there's a little kind of an epilogue to that story. So, as I said, I looked at her and I decided not to tell her anything, that this is impenetrable skull. You know, you'll never get through to her. No facts, no description will get through to her. So I didn't bother, but I did say, but by the way, those bankers and Wall Street crooks who took the bailout, the ones who invent the toxic acids and the derivatives, they're not white.
That's right.
Jews.
Yep.
So they're not white, they're Jews. All those bankers and Wall Street crooks, even the insurance giant AIG, that is American International Group, which got a huge bailout because it's too big to fail. I said, even that's run by Jews.
Yeah, and who granted it, exactly, the Federal Reserve, right?
From the Federal Reserve, which masterminded the bailout to Goldman Sachs, the masters of the financial system and the criminals behind the bailout, they're Jews.
Yep.
And I said to her, hair will grow on my palm before they let a white man anywhere near the real levers of power. So just stop condemning your own people of this corruption. And you know what? Her face changed. There was a look of slight bit of trepidation, fear on her face. She looked nervous all of a sudden. It was as if I had taken her into forbidden territory. And it's like she had been a small girl caught listening to forbidden talk. You know?
Right.
And she said, she kind of shook up, practically, you know, stuttered and said, that's dangerously close to racism. I looked at her face and I said, the stop sign has gone up in your brain. Now this woman can't think. She can't absorb facts. She can't assess facts. She can't process anything. Because a stop sign has gone up. I said that those people aren't white, they're actually Jews, those people who did the corruption. And now the stop sign has gone up. She can't think. She couldn't even talk. But think about it. When it came to thinking and believing that her own people, white people, her own people are stupendously corrupt, then she could process everything. She was full of enthusiasm and conviction.
Interesting, huh? Yeah. It's true, Frank. So let me just add.
Story is.
Let me just add in there that it's true that seemingly intellectual and to a certain extent high IQ liberal people and whites in general, they become like children, extremely childish when it comes to issues of race or what they consider to be racism. It's like they completely shut down, right? And I still don't know if it's just the programming or something. We don't have to go into the details of that right now, but it's a true observation that basically it just intellectually stops and there's like no way that you can proceed forward. Very interesting.
Well, I think with emotional programming, and the program is emotional, they show you, Hollywood movies show you very emotional things about this cruel white man swinging the whip. Or there was a movie called, I'm trying to remember what that movie was called, that was based on a film called The Order, on a group called The Order, that's conducted a brief insurrection, a white revolution in the Pacific Northwest. The film was acted by Tom Berenger. The film claimed it was based on true facts on The Order, but it made up things. It made up the fact that these racists, they caught hold of a black man, and then they told him to run. He was given 5 minutes, and then they were going to hunt him with their rifles. And then you saw the face of this black man distended with terror, his eyes distended, his mouth slavering, his face twisted in terror. That's emotional programming. And then behind him run these white men with their guns. That's emotional programming. Now, emotional programming can shut down a part of the brain and leave another part okay. So this high-functioning liberal that you were speaking of, the intelligent ones, they can go to their work and be an air traffic controller, which is a demanding job. And yet another part of their brain, the patriotism, the awareness of their kith and kin, that part can be shut down.
Yeah.
So I think they've proved something, that you can selectively shut down parts of the brain and make you a child or a moron in some parts, while you can remain intelligent in other parts.
It's true. Yeah, yeah. I don't have any else to add to that. That's true.
So the end of the story of that particular story of this particular liberal was that she has no idea of the conditions in the third world, of the bad habits and behaviors of colored people. Even a white nationalist has little idea. So before I go into an analysis, I'll tell you four incidents from my own experience, and my own experience is a typical experience. It's a slice of a bigger pie. That might tell you of the tremendous difference among these people, okay? So I'll say the first one. I was in Hong Kong in the year 92, I believe. 92, I was in Hong Kong. And I was on a very busy street where they had all these stalls selling T-shirts, selling scarves, selling jewelry. So So these are stalls on the street, but pretty big stalls. They're not small. They're as big as a kiosk. And most of them were by Chinese or some by Indians. Now, it so happens that a certain breed of Indian has done very well in Hong Kong, just buying and selling. And there was this stall run by these Indians who had come, I could see, from the western part of India. They were pretty fair, comparatively, pretty big in size. And they were a family. There were two brothers, and then there was a younger brother. And they were busy at their stuff. But this young man of about 24, the younger brother, he wasn't that busy. He was looking out. He was looking out at all the people passing by, and it's a very crowded street. And he suddenly saw this elderly white American man. The man might have been close to 80. An elderly man, he was alone. And at close to 80, he walks a little bent over. He's physically weak. And this young man, he sees him, and this look of the predator comes into his face. You know, it's like a spider that's seen a fly. There's a certain aggression, meanness, and eagerness. And he jumped down. He ran over to that man, and he shoved him very hard, pushed him. And the man almost fell, but then he straightened himself, this elderly American. And he said, "You know what? I don't like being pushed on the street, and I don't like being touched on the street either." And this fellow said, "Don't talk back to me. Who the hell do you think you are? You get out of here, and don't you ever come back." Completely unprovoked, literally run over to that man to attack him. Well, that man was not the white man of today. Back in 92, an 80-year-old American is not the same as today's middle-class American who would have just run away. He was elderly, he was shorter, smaller, bent over, but you know what? He walked right back to where the stall was and said, "I will go where I like. Don't tell me, never come here again. I'll go where I please." And then he saw the two brothers, the elder brothers, who were at least 35 and 40, and said, "Is this guy belong to you? He just attacked me and shoved me. He tells me I can't go where I like." Well, I thought these two brothers would rebuke their younger brother. I thought they'd say, "What the hell are you doing, attacking people? Secondly, we do business here. We don't want a bad name. We don't want a complaint." But instead, they started mocking this elderly man, the two brothers, and one of them said, "What do you mean you want to go where you'll go where you like? You want to go to the moon?" I'm trying to copy his accent. "You want to go to the moon?" He said, "I'll go where I like." And they said, what does this guy think? He's mad." So all three of them were surrounding this one man, and they're saying, "You get out of here and don't you ever come back again. Go fuck yourself." Well, I was watching, and the man said, "I'm going all right. I'm going to the police." And he walked off, still erect, still proud. And then this youngest fellow noticed me watching, because I was watching very quietly. I was just watching. He looked at me, and he looked at me twice, thinking, you know, is he going to come over and try bullying me? And says, "You know, what's your problem? What are you looking at?" He decided, after a second look at me, he decided not to say anything. But I noted that incident. Now, I ask you something, Henrik. Never in my life have I seen a white man do that to a non-white. Never.
Right.
Even when these people are intruders in their country, when they're taking over their neighborhoods, but they don't go and attack a helpless person for the fun of it or to assert some envy that is burning them up.
Right.
I've never seen a white man do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never seen a young white do that to an elderly white. You know, they might rob them. They might try to grab some money off them. But they'll certainly not do it for the sadistic pleasure of it.
Right, yeah.
So there's a difference in racial behavior. This kind of envy of somebody else, envy for whatever reason, he's from a richer society, he's from a more handsome race, whatever that envy is not present in whites, but it is there in coloreds.
Do you think, Frank, that let's assume that we would remove kind of the hatred that we get in the in the mass media these days, in Europe and in America, that, you know, it's very hostile to the native population. We're charged as being these racists and suppressing other people all the time and these kinds of things. And I think it exacerbates this problem immensely. But let's assume that the liberal press would just kind of stop with their activities. Do you assume that this would diminish or go down, these kinds of attacks, or would that still be there? Is it, what I'm saying is it an artificially kind of induced issue, a problem, or is it there in, by default to a certain extent?
Yeah, no. It's there as an innate part of human nature. This, you know, I just told you a story of Hong Kong. There's no liberal media in Hong Kong. Okay.
Right. I thought maybe the UK still had influence there or something.
Absolutely no. None. Right. There is nothing there. There's only Chinese movies, and there is no brainwashing going on in Hong Kong. I've seen similar things happen all over the world, in the third world, where it's just pure racial envy. It is an envy of a more successful race, of a more good-looking race, of a more a race that has happiness, obviously. It's envy of the rich tourist, partly, that he can, with his wad of dollars, he can buy what this person can't earn in 6 months, right?
Right.
It's envy, but the main envy is physical. It's the white body, those blue eyes that are so innocent, that seem to look out in a somewhat visionary way. It's physical. But there's a difference in racial behaviors. That kind of itching resentment, envy, and desire to hurt a complete stranger, it's not there among whites. I'll give you an example now from a true story of something that while I was running a small factory, this was in Bangladesh, I was running a small factory, and I had this fellow who was pretty needed in the factory. He was able to run a machine, which most people can't. But he was an aggressive man. His name was Hamid, a very Arabic name. All Muslims, by the way, in India, on the Indian subcontinent, have Arabic or Persian names.
Yeah.
So this Hamid was one of your more assertive people, one of your more aggressive people. You know, he'd argue back, though I was the owner's son. He would demand things constantly, and he'd claim that he was tough. You know, he tried to show the other workers that he was a tough person. One day he was telling me that I'll take a dollar more, but I won't take a dollar less. I'll never take $1 less. You know, if he works 1 minute past 5 o'clock, he'll want overtime for that 1 minute. That kind of person, very aggressive, confrontational, unnecessarily confrontational all the time, not just asserting his rights, but confrontational all the time. And yet one day he came in looking as sweet as pie, looking as if he was like a horse that was about to whinny like a stallion. And I said, well, what do you want? And he's looking like a young schoolboy asking a favor. And as it happens, we had a contractor, a carpenter on contract, a Hindu, and this contractor had wanted to borrow his tools. So Hamid says that the contractor, Harish, he wants to borrow my tools. I said, so why bother me? They're your tools. But, you know, I don't do anything without your guidance, sir. He says, he's asked me for these tools. Shall I give them? He said it in Bengali. But he put his voice like a little schoolgirl. He spoke in an uncharacteristic voice, almost musical. I mean, Dimu, shall I give it? And I said, that's so unlike this man. You know, he's practically speaking musically now. You know, I said, well, it's your tools. Why are you asking me? You want to lend your tools to someone, you lend them. Why are you bothering me about it? They're not mine. He said, but sir, I don't do anything outside the parameters you set. And if you tell me not to do something, there's nothing, not even, you know, nothing can force me to, nothing would make me do it. You know, now he's suddenly my disciple. He doesn't do anything without my advice, doesn't go beyond any parameters I set. And if I were to say to him, don't do this, he would never do it. He'd rather die than commit such an offense. Such a different behavior. Well, I didn't quite understand what the hell's going on. I said, well, you know, I don't see any harm in it. And I thought that was the end of it. Except a few days later, he turns up and says that I lent my tools to this carpenter as you told me to. Now it's not permitted or advised. Now it's told. And he's damaged one of them. I said, well. He said, well, he expects me to pay for it. He expects me to pay like $15 to replace that tool. I said, why the hell should I pay? It is your tools. You lent them. But you told me to give them. You told me. If you hadn't told me, I wouldn't have done it. And then it changed from there to I didn't really want to do it, but you ordered me to do it. Now, what he had wanted really when he came to me looking like a bashful schoolgirl and blushing and stuttering, so unlike himself, was that he wanted me to guarantee. He wanted something for free from me. He couldn't even lend something to somebody else without having to take something from me, a guarantee. He wants something for free, in short. Well, I realized I'd been stupid here. I hadn't understood that there's cunning and deceit behind everything in my society. And I paid up the $15, telling myself, anytime anyone ever asks for something ever again, I'll assume he's up to the worst.
Right.
Because they're always up to the worst. Now, here was an example, really, of a man wanting something for free from someone else, always trying to take from someone else. Here he took a guarantee from me and took $15 from me. Now, I ask you, can a white man even imagine the thinking and tactics of this incident?
No, I sure can't. Anyway, if I speak for myself.
Could you even, if someone had asked X to borrow his tools or to borrow his car or something, would X go to somebody else and say, should I do it as a sly way of making him guarantee it?
No.
That wouldn't happen. It's beyond the thinking of a white man. So there's example of racial behavior, which that is uniquely colored and not so nice. Very selfish, very self-aggrandizing, using other people behavior. And I will relate it to the self-universal outlook as we go along.
No, Frank, we're going to take a break here in a little bit between the segments. I want to hear more about this, and you have much more to share as we proceed kind of in the setup that you have for us here today. It's really interesting. It's always good to hear these stories because they get kind of in close and personal. They're specific examples. You know, we generally end up talking in generalities and broad stroked, you know, kind of concept and things like this, which is good. You need that overview. But you also need this ability to kind of zoom in on specific examples to kind of relate to the audience of real how all of this plays out in real life, you know. So this is really good stuff. Tell us a bit more about the book. Yeah, I always want to make sure that we plug that, Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells. You said it helps to convert, you know, liberals. So we definitely want to have more of those copies out there being spread to people. Tell us a bit more about the book.
Well, I wrote the book partly because of these stories I'm telling you. Partly when I saw the big difference, and I saw how in the West people are told that there is no difference. In fact, the only difference is those people are better. The Hollywood movie says the colored person is better. I decided to write the book as a kind of informative exercise and to really tell people. But above all, I wanted to tell white people how their soul differed. The soul that dwells in the forest and the sea, the soul that is part of all nature. I wanted to tell them their identity, because it's almost impossible for a white person today to know his true identity, what makes him different from the other races, what he would lose, what spiritual richnesses he would lose. So I wrote Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells, not so much thinking of my own, actually I lost a great deal by doing it. I was thinking that the world would become a very dirty, materialistic, dangerous place if white people disappear, if this very idealistic people who want to make the earth a better place, who want to go to Africa and build hospitals there to for the benighted people there. If this generous and kindly people, these people who cared about nature and had a universal outlook and wanted to save the earth, if they disappear, it'll be terrible. That's why I wrote it, but I did write it as a story. If I wrote it as a documentary, you'd get mighty bored.
Right. Yeah.
You do know that Patrick Buchanan, the American thinker and politician, he wrote a book called The Death of the West.
That's right. Yeah.
And in this book, he talked numbers about how whites were declining in number, having less children, how there were the percentage of non-whites had risen. And you know what? People didn't read it. It made the bestseller list for a couple of weeks, and then now it's forgotten. Because a documentary, a statement of facts, is not very interesting. You need a story and characters and some real-life stuff. You know, like you said, generalities alone don't do it. You need some more specific stuff. So I think that anyone who reads it will be entertained, not just informed, but entertained. And I did try to write it in a literary style so that people will enjoy the way things are related. You know, Shakespeare is good because he can arouse emotion.
That's right. Exactly. That's just it. So we need more of, in fact. So it's very good. We need these different angles to it. All right. So we'll have a link up, of course, to the Amazon page for the book. Is there any other way that you want people to reach out to you? Frank, I don't know if there's any emails you want to give out or if you have any social media channels or something like that for the book.
Well, I think they really should just go to your Red Ice site and go to the YouTube video that you later put out. And if they want to know my thoughts, there's no point in contacting me about it. The thoughts are in the book. They are there. They are surprising. I think they should really just focus on the book. And now it's in paperback, it's so much easier to read. And I think the best thing they could do for their people, their country, their future, is to let their friends read it, their liberal friends. Let them read it. Let their sisters and brothers read it.
Yeah.
It does change the minds of people. So it's a very powerful tool for the cause against white genocide, for the preservation of their own neighborhoods, for that matter.
Very good. Well, exactly. Yeah, thank you again for speaking out for us, Frank, and bringing attention to it. We need all the allies that we can get all over the place, and we welcome everyone who sees what's happening in the world and the larger scope. I think, as you said, it's also something at the end of the day that's going to hurt everybody in that sense. All right. Well, we'll have the link up. We'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen.
I'll
stay with us, Frank.
Add one sentence.
Sure, go ahead. Yep.
They also need more people like you who will stand up uncompromisingly. If there were 20 Henricks in the world today, you'd have a much better... You'd have a much more cause for optimism right now.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. We'll get to the cloning here soon, so... All right, folks, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. More with Frank Raymond coming up. The second hour with Frank Raymond is coming up. We do the second hour of our show for members. This is how we can remain ad-free and spare you from commercial interruptions. This, of course, also helps us to grow and has enabled us to start new projects, such as our live TV show that we now do on the weekends. And we also want to get more people aboard and help to produce more and cover more. So if you like what we do, please support us. Sign up for a membership with us. It's only €6 per month. And we do have subscriptions from 3 months up to 2 years available. You'll get full access to our archives, over 1,000 shows and more added into it every single week. RedIceMembers.com is the website. Go there and we'll talk to you more after the break.